Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Congress is gone, the president's out of town, but official Washington is still hard at work. The EPA had some thoughts on climate change today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the all-new Chevrolet Volt, available soon in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. The all-new Chevrolet Volt, it's more car than electric. And by MassMutual, with financial professionals nationwide who are trained to serve the unique financial needs of their clients at MassMutual.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's December the 23rd, today, Thursday. Good as always to have you with us. So now that the mad rush of the lame duck session and the rest of the 111th Congress is behind us, a moment to consider what didn't get done in Washington this year. A federal budget, for one, immigration reform, also a long-promised climate change bill. Today, the Environmental Protection Agency stepped in where Congress feared to tread. The EPA said it's going to start coming out with some new rules to regulate greenhouse gas emissions next year, and they're going to start with power plants and refineries. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
Greenhouse gas rules were just a matter of legal time, says Franz Litz at the World Resources Institute.
When the Supreme Court decided that greenhouse gases are a pollutant back in 2007, they essentially set this cart in motion.
Now come the details, as in which sectors to regulate first. Here's the EPA's Gina McCarthy in a conference call this morning.
In refineries and power plants, we have large amounts of emissions. We have relatively few sources to regulate.
She says by the end of 2011, the agency will develop standards for emissions based on what's achievable for the industry. As of today, there are no specifics on what achievable means. But in any event, Ethan Zindler at Bloomberg New Energy Finance assumes the oldest, dirtiest coal plants aren't likely to pass muster.
There clearly are aging plants that are coming to the end of their useful life. These regulations could hasten their fade into history.
Some coal plants may die. Others may switch to another fuel, as in natural gas, the new low-cost kid on the block. And gas emits half the carbon of coal.
There's a lot of coal to natural gas switching taking place, frankly, with or without the EPA.
One industry estimate suggests 16% of coal plants will close in the next few years. Zindler says to some, a transition away from coal is no surprise. In fact, some plan for it. More than 30 states pass rules forcing utilities to buy renewable energy. And some utilities invested in cleaner energy on their own. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
If you made your holiday gifts this year, and if you did, good for you. There's a decent chance you bought your materials at a Joann Fabric and Craft store someplace. The chain sells, just like it sounds, arts and crafts and sewing supplies. Not an outfit you'd ordinarily think of as a target for private equity buyers. But that's exactly what happened today. And Marketplace's Elisa Roth explains it's not really about scrapbooking or cross-stitching.
Don't expect Wall Street types to suddenly develop an interest in embroidery or macrame.
Yeah, I don't think they have a strong desire to be arts and crafts people.
Mark Mandel follows Joann's stores for Think Equity. He says Leonard Green, the private equity firm, is just looking for a good bargain.
So generally, it's a fairly stable business. It's fairly predictable. A well-run company is going to generate significant cash, and Joann's falls into that group.
A lot of Leonard Green's holdings fit into that group. The Container Store, Whole Foods, Neiman Marcus, and most recently, J. Crew. What all those companies have in common is their successful stores. Colin Bladen directs the Center for Private Equity and Entrepreneurship at the Tuck School. He says everybody, especially private equity, is excited about retail these days.
They think the recent unpleasantness, the recession, the sluggish start to any recovery has put the retail operations in a hole that with a recovery looming in front of them, they expect them to climb out of and show very attractive growth.
Joanne Stores has until early next year to consider other buyout offers. But Mandel, the analyst, and others say this one will be hard to beat. The $61 a share is more than a third above yesterday's closing price. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
The internet, as most of us know, can be an amazingly valuable tool. It can also be a colossal waste of time. All told, we watched 700 billion YouTube videos this year. That's according to the company itself. It's also a whole lot of Justin Bieber and random cat videos. But all of those songs and bloopers and bad comedy come at a price. We asked Marketplace's Adrian Hill to find out just how much energy the internet uses.
17 million people have watched a 3-year-old cry over a YouTube pop star.
I love Justin Bieber.
You're crying because you love Justin Bieber?
Yes, I do.
But watching that gym and doing all the other things we do online, from paying our bills to downloading movies, takes electricity. Electricity to power data centers, servers, computers, and iPhones. Author Stan Cox estimates that next year, the U.S. digital network will drain as much energy as the whole country of Mexico produces. All that energy creates CO2. According to Molly Webb of the Climate Group, information technology systems globally account for 2-3% of total carbon emissions. And
it is growing, and it's growing mainly because of the new applications, video.
But Rich Brown from the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory says it's important to keep it in perspective. The internet is still a relatively small energy suck compared to things like cars.
That shouldn't be the primary focus of where we're trying to reduce energy use. You know, there's a lot bigger fish to fry.
Which means I don't have to feel too guilty about spending a few minutes watching the latest Taylor Swift video, except maybe that it's Taylor Swift. I'm Adrian Hill from Marketplace.
Yeah, Taylor Swift. Anyway, while we're talking energy, you might want to check out oil. Crude closed up a buck today, $91.51 a barrel. That is a 2-year high, in case you're keeping track. Elsewhere in the markets today, onward and upward. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a trend among some of the richest people in the world that you might have heard about. They're giving their money away. Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg, all of them have promised to give away most of what they have during their lifetimes. So, too, has Toby Ord. Of course, he's got substantially less money to get rid of. Toby is a university researcher over in Oxford, England. He earns just a bit more than the average wage in Britain. Still, he figures he can give away more than $1.5 million in his lifetime, and he wants others to think about doing the same. From Oxford, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Toby Ord and his wife live in a modest, sparsely furnished, one-bedroom rented apartment. Except for a laptop and an iPhone, the couple enjoy few luxuries. But that's because they're planning to give most of what they earn to charity.
In percentage terms, I'm going to be giving around about two-thirds, or 67% of my income over my life.
Toby, who's 31 years old, reckons that as an academic, he'll probably earn a total of $2.25 million during his career. He's pledged to give around $1.5 million of that to the developing world, to the most cost-effective cause he could find.
I could save about 2,200 lives over the course of my life if I donated the money to the most effective ways to fight tuberculosis in developing countries.
After his donations, Toby is currently living on around $27,000 a year, and he insists that buys him everything he wants. His wife, Bernadette, a junior hospital doctor, is also donating a similar chunk of her income and also says she doesn't feel in any way deprived.
Not having particularly fabulous clothes, in, you know, designer labels and things, not driving a fancy car, none of that to me is a big, you know, sacrifice.
What about expensive vacations? Surely once or twice in your life you'd like to really let rip and go somewhere exotic?
Honestly, no.
The couple launched a website to spread the word. GivingWhatWeCan.org urges people to sign a promise to donate at least 10% of their income for the rest of their lives. 23-year-old Will Crouch, another Oxford academic, was an early recruit.
We just have more money than we know what to do with. This means we could spend it on ourselves in a way that I don't think makes us particularly happy, or we could spend it on others.
Will is hardly rich. He currently earns an extremely modest $25,000 a year, but he's donating a third of that. He does admit the odd twinge when he passes through Oxford's opulent shopping centre.
I mean, in the same way, I'm vegetarian and very occasionally I pass McDonald's and have some sort of compulsion to stuff myself with a Big Mac. But it's really quite a weak voice in my head.
The moment passes quite quickly.
Yeah, the moment passes very quickly.
One niggling doubt about the donors. Wouldn't it be better if they performed their philanthropy on the quiet? Toby Ord.
I don't enjoy the publicity. However, I think that it is actually very useful for trying to get people to think seriously about whether they could use some of their income to dramatically transform other people's lives.
If this caught on, it could dramatically transform Britain's consumer economy. But the UK's retail sector is safe for now. So far, the total number of donors Toby Ord has enlisted is just 63. In Oxford, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
We're taking some time this week and next to recap the year gone by in the American economy. 2010 brought the prospect of big change to the way one of every $7 is spent in this country. Healthcare, of course. The reform bill was signed into law last March. The year ended, though, with some questions about its future after a federal judge in Virginia declared part of that law unconstitutional. That would be the individual mandate, the requirement that everybody has to buy health insurance. For more, we've got Gregory Warner with us from our health desk in Philadelphia. Hey, Gregory.
Hello, Kai.
So can we say now, given this court case in Virginia, that healthcare is off track?
Politically, it depends who you talk to. And legally, we're really in a wait-and-see mode. We're waiting for the Supreme Court. Economically speaking, though, it's not totally clear how much difference this individual mandate really makes. And the reason I say that is that in this version of the mandate, the penalties for breaking the law for not buying insurance aren't that high. It's really a more politically compromised mandate. Not exactly toothless, but a lot of those teeth got extracted in that long political slog toward reform. Here's Mark Pauly's take. He's an economist at the University of Pennsylvania who helped design a tougher version of the mandate for the first Bush administration.
It really isn't likely to change behavior all that much. So it's had a lot more effect on law professors than it's likely to have on actual buyers of insurance.
Well, then help me figure out what healthcare reform looks like without the mandate.
Well, remember, Kai, the mandate was actually a Republican idea back in the day, an alternative to universal healthcare. The thought was better to make people buy insurance than give it to them with taxes. Compared to how insurance works now, which is this escalating cycle of more and more people losing coverage every year, most people say that some way of getting more people in the system has to happen to get premiums cheaper. That isn't necessarily a mandate, though. You can have an opt-out system where if you don't buy health insurance now, you can't buy it for 5 years. You could have an extremely strong employer mandate, or you could bring back single-payer universal health care and see how far you get in Washington.
There is something, though, that I think hasn't been talked about in a long time in this whole debate, and which is the place that health care reform started, the thing that we were going to do with this Reform Act, and that is get health care costs under control. Is anything we're talking about right now going to do that?
No, and the public debate is all about this political question. Privately, though, I've been having this experience doing reporting the past few months where I'll call one of my sources, maybe in academia or the think tank world, only to be told by that person, you know, Gregory, hey, this is the last time we'll be able to talk. And I say, why? And they say, well, because I'm going to work for the administration. And then this happened so often, I started to wonder, where are they all going? Turns out many of them are going to these various committees, which the idea is will do something about healthcare costs.
Yeah, these are the committees, the pilot programs that the reform law set up, right?
Exactly. And some of these committees are about incentivizing insurance companies to provide what's called high-value care or more prevention, fewer, you know, knee replacements. Others are about making hospitals more efficient using electronic records. And then there's this thing called the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Innovation, which is creating rules for the accountable care organizations. I won't say much about that because we're going to hear a whole lot about them in 2011. But basically, it's a new model for paying doctors and hospitals.
Well, speaking of 2011, there are some things happening in the new year with this healthcare reform law, yeah?
Sure. 2011, we have seniors in the Medicare donut hole getting half off brand drugs. Small businesses get grants to help workers lose weight. Wealthy Americans pay more for Medicare, and then something called nutritional labeling, where chain restaurants have to post their calorie counts of everything on the menu, everything except for the daily special, which means we might expect Americans to forsake their double cheeseburger and choose instead their daily special cheese-soaked chocolate shake, rib, and fries, because, Kai, what you don't know can't kill you.
And it just tastes so much better. Gregory Warner at the Marketplace Health Desk at the WHYY in Philadelphia. Gregory, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up, a special kind of wish list.
If your Santa Claus was an engineer, what would you like for your next Christmas?
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials ticked up 14 points today, and that's about a 10%, closed at 11,573. The Nasdaq lost 5 points, 0.2%, 2665 at the bell. The S&P 500 edged down 2 points, about a 10%. Ended things at 1256 for the week, because everybody on Wall Street is off tomorrow. The Dow climbed 0.7%. The S&P 500 rose 1%. The Nasdaq clicked up 0.9%. The Commerce Department said today new home sales were lower than expected. That drove down home builder stock. Hovnanian fell 5%. KB Home and Lennar Corporation dismantled more than 4%. Pulte Group and D.R. Horton each raised more than 3% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.38%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Novo Nordisk. Since 1923, innovative developer of diabetes treatments and delivery devices at novonordisk-us.com. By T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at troweprice.com. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll also find our new podcasts, The Midday Update, Freakonomics, and The Tech Report, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. It's Christmas Eve. I'm a purist and I say no opening gifts until Christmas Day, but shaking them is okay. The president is in Hawaii. The markets are closed. Yep, should be pretty quiet. Unless you're one of those people who didn't do your Christmas shopping yet. Then you'll be busy. In that case, good luck to you. I'm Michelle Philippi.
It's Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. If you happen to be a big fan of the 100-watt incandescent light bulb, you've got just about a year left to stock up. Come New Year's Day 2012, you're not going to be able to buy them in this country anymore. If that news catches you by surprise, you've got plenty of company. Surveys show a lot of Americans don't know about a federal law that will phase out most incandescent bulbs by 2014. Some cities and towns across the country are trying to get ahead of the curve. They've switched from traditional Christmas lights this year to decorations that use light-emitting diodes, or LEDs. But as Shannon Mullen reports, the new look of LEDs can take some getting used to.
LED holiday lights are brighter these days than they've ever been, but you still know them when you see them. Even the newest strands can look cold and dim compared to the warm glow of their incandescent counterparts. So imagine what LEDs looked like back in 2007, when the town of Concord, Massachusetts, bought them for its holiday tree and flipped the switch.
As opposed to the cheer, I think there was a little bit of a groan that there wasn't nearly as much light.
Town manager Chris Whalen says he got a lot of complaints about the LEDs.
I'm sympathetic with the folks who thought it was a much colder winter light than people were accustomed to. So I can see what they're saying. But as billed, they saved 90% of our electric bill for the whole season, which we thought was great.
And Whalen says taxpayers have been asking town officials to save energy and money wherever possible. Concord's also experimenting with LED technology to comply with new federal energy efficiency standards. They're part of a law passed during the last Bush administration that phases out many common incandescent light bulbs consumers use today by 2014. LEDs use a fraction of the energy, and the technology has been around for decades, but its use in holiday lights was still a novelty when Concord bought them. It can't justify upgrading to the latest models, so residents are stuck with the dim bulbs, and some say less holiday spirit. But other cities and towns are just buying in.
Our customers, they run the gamut from a small mom-and-pop town that might need just basic traditional decorations to Yonkers, New York, which, you know, put in a large LED giant Christmas tree in our town square this year.
Mike Streb is sales director for Christmas Lights, Etc. He says last year his company sold more LEDs than incandescents for the first time. Streb adds that LEDs are getting cheaper, but customers still pay 3 to 4 times more for them.
They know that even though there's some upfront investment, that the payback by investing in a product that can deliver great energy savings, that they can recoup their costs over the long run.
We've had this conversation at home about switching over to LEDs, but I usually lose out. You know, other people at home want the brighter lights.
That's Concord taxpayer Steve Barrett. He says he used to get more resistance to his LED idea when his argument was just about saving energy. But this year, the discussion also had to do with saving money. And even though he lost again, it was by a much smaller margin.
People struggle with those questions about doing green things and, you know, how things look. If everything is LED, then we won't know any difference.
Concord's heading in that direction. Town manager Chris Whalen says there are already LED lights in some town buildings and some newly installed traffic lights.
And we find that they're brighter, they work very well, but learn that the light is cold, so it doesn't melt away the snow in the winter, so we may have to brush the snow away from the traffic lights. So that was an unplanned result for us.
Whalen cautions other towns that are looking into LED technology to make sure they do their research first. In Concord, Massachusetts, I'm Shannon Mullen for Marketplace.
In all the gift-giving that's going to happen this weekend, there are going to be some great presents. Exciting, amazing, heartfelt gifts. Probably not too many, though, that'll change somebody's life. A robotics workshop in Seattle has taken the holiday tradition and given it a high-tech twist, as Marketplace's Steve Henn explains.
You know in the movie The Terminator, Arnold Schwarzenegger has this robotic hand. Yoki Matsuka built a real one. It's a fully articulated robotic hand that she thinks one day could respond to human nerve signals. Yoki's a pioneer in the field of neurorobotics, and that hand made her kind of famous. A few years ago, she started getting emails from parents of disabled kids asking if there were things she could build to help them.
Most of the time, I couldn't do anything, but sometimes there were things that I could do almost on the side as a hobby to build something for them.
Once, she built all-terrain crutches. And then Yoki won the MacArthur Genius Award. It comes with $500,000 in prize money. Yoki used some of the cash to launch a nonprofit called Yoki Works that asks disabled kids this question.
If your Santa Claus was an engineer, what would you like for your next Christmas?
Then Yoki Works tries to build what they ask for. And some of the contraptions it comes up with can be life-changing.
I heard Yoki speak at a conference that took place at Seattle Children's Hospital.
Beth McCarthy is a physical therapist. She had been helping care for a little girl named Maria Ortiz Batista since Maria was 4 months old. Maria has severe cerebral palsy. She's locked inside a body that doesn't do what she asks it to.
To somebody who doesn't know her, she has almost no understandable verbal speech.
Maria can say yes or no, but she can't initiate any kind of conversation. She can't walk. She can't use traditional buttons or joysticks. If she's thirsty, she has to wait until someone asks her if she'd like a drink. She has no way to express her own ideas or desires or needs. Still, Beth and Maria's parents have been convinced for years that there is this bright, engaging little kid trapped inside.
She smiled. She laughed. She understands a lot of language. She understands Spanish and English. if I try and speak Spanish to her, which I'm not a Spanish speaker, my Spanish is terrible, she will laugh at me. Gracias. Boom. I know you're having a silly fit, aren't you?
A year ago, YokiWorks launched the Maria Project. Step one, build a machine Maria can use on her own to communicate.
You can just imagine she's in a, you know, very hard situation.
Gary Chu is one of the engineers in the project.
I kind of think of her like those people who are paralyzed or have locked-in syndrome, where, you know, they have all these things going around their head, but they can't really communicate them.
Eventually, Gary pieced together a gadget using an old Toys R Us electric drum set and a laptop. It has four big buttons that are far enough apart that Maria can hit them accurately.
Right now, it gives her an opportunity to spontaneously say, you know, I'm thirsty, I want some water. Then this button means I want to watch a movie.
She can tell people she's hungry or needs to go to the bathroom. Her dad, Hector Ortiz, says the device has already changed their lives. He can see that Maria's learning. And the next step is to teach Maria to use this device to make letters.
You know, it'd be great if she can get to a point that she can basically have a keyboard that she can control on her own.
Then they'll teach her to write.
What we're hoping to do is give her a means that she will be able to spontaneously produce her own speech, what she wants to say.
And eventually explore the world.
Go to college, get a job, you know, all those things that would completely enable her in a different way than what she, in sort of the current path that she's on.
And even though the device YokiWorks created was designed with only Maria in mind, Yoki hopes some of the technologies will have commercial uses. If they do, that intellectual property YokiWorks created could help fund the workshop for years. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by Putnam Investments, dedicated to helping financial advisors and their clients pursue a more comfortable retirement. You can get the latest at RothIRAblog.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, a comment on the value of being left alone, or at least not being observed while you're online. The folks at Gallup have done a new poll. Overall, about two-thirds, 61% of Americans, don't want advertisers to be able to target online ads based on one's web browsing history, even in exchange for more free content. That varies generationally, as you might expect. Older web surfers are more protective of their information than younger ones are. Here's the best part, though. In every age bracket and at every point on the income distribution, 90% of people or more say they don't pay attention to those ads. Anyway. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Thursday. Today, the Dow ticked up 14 points, about a tenth percent. The NASDAQ off 5. That is 0.2%. The S&P 500 edged down 2 points, about a tenth of 1%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time, back on this show, does everybody in your family deserve a gift?
Every year someone says, oh, let's draw names out of a hat, and I just think that's such a ripoff.
I know, me too. I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.